Hello, students. Thank you for coming out on this very inclement and thunderous night. My name is Hollis Palmer. I work for Seattle Arts and Lectures, and I wanted to welcome you all to our final lecture of the winter course, Storytelling Uprising, co-presented with the UW's Master of Communication in Digital Media. And before I introduce our speaker for tonight, I just wanted to let you know a little bit more about our upcoming course in the spring. It's called Following Wendell, The Culture and Politics of Sustenance, and it begins just a couple of weeks from tomorrow. This course will be presented in partnership with the UW's Program on the Environment and in honor of Wendell Berry, who is going to be visiting Seattle with SAL on May 24th as part of our American Voices series. The course that we're presenting in the spring will feature a compelling group of thinkers, authors, and farmers who will cover a wide range of topics related to food and our environment, such as food deserts, not desserts, deserts, obesity, and urban farming. The series will conclude with a special Saturday trip to tour the University of Washington's farm, which educates the community about the impact of our food choices and models how we can reduce those impacts. The five lectures will take place on a Thursday instead of a Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the Henry Art Gallery, beginning on April 21st. And the course will conclude with a tour of the UW farm, which includes Prosecco and pizza from the farm's wood-fired oven. So it's a not miss. We have a special deal for people who purchase a ticket to the Wendell Berry event. You get 15% off of the price of the class. And if you're interested in that, you can go online. And the discount code is BerrySalU, B-E-R-R-Y. S-A-L-U. And of course, if you're a UW student, faculty or staff member, or an alum, there's also a 15% discount on the class. So I hope that some of you will consider coming to this wonderful opportunity that's going to start April 21st. Now, I would like to welcome our final lecturer who's going to bring it all together for you, Miss Anita Verna Cross. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me? Great. So last month I flew to Namibia, and it takes a long time to get to Namibia. There really is no fast way to get there. Typically it's about three legs of a flight, and it usually involves an overnight in Johannesburg in South Africa. And you can go through Amsterdam or Frankfurt or London. And if you really are masochistic, you can do the 14-hour marathon from Atlanta to Johannesburg. And having done that once, I will do everything in my power never to do that leg again. So on this most recent trip, I opted for Amsterdam. And I transferred from Amsterdam and went down to Johannesburg. And as I said, I stayed overnight. Now, for anyone that's been to the Johannesburg airport, you know that compared to SeaTac, the Johannesburg airport makes SeaTac look woefully plain. Some of you who are soccer fans in the room might remember that South Africa hosted the World Cup last year, the first time the World Cup actually was played on African soil, and this was a really big deal. When you think about the World Cup, you've got to imagine that you take the Super Bowl, March Madness, the World Series, throw in NASCAR, sure, let's put the Masters in there as well, and you are still not approaching what the energy around the World Cup is. And the South African organizers knew that given the influx of guests that were going to be coming to South Africa, the first and the last thing they would see is the airport. And so it is a vision of modernity. But it's not just the architecture of the Johannesburg Airport that really puts SeaTac's international wing to shame. It's actually the bathrooms. As soon as I cleared customs, even though I hadn't taken the 14-hour flight, after flying for 11 hours and having all that recycled air and airplane food, I couldn't wait to brush my teeth. So I headed straight to the restroom, and this was the sign that that was posted on the wall. For people that can't read the small print, it's an invitation from the Johannesburg Airport to text your opinion of the bathroom to a central customer service. Now, even though I was in that mildly strung-out state, I knew that I had stumbled onto the perfect intro for tonight's discussion, because this sign embodies existing realities around new media and emerging markets. To start, it's Exhibit A of perfectly normal mobile phone behavior in South Africa, and more generally, it's representative of the incredible uptick in mobile phone use in emerging markets. I've yet to see a similar sign in a U.S. airport that asks you to explicitly text your opinions to a customer service agency. Now, maybe there's some signs out there with a telephone number, but nothing that's explicit as a text. And I've seen plenty of American restrooms that wouldn't even dare put a phone number up on the wall, lest what would unfold. And finally, I really think that this sign relates to engagement, or more specifically, the concept of engagement intelligence that Hanson Hossain introduced in the first lecture of this series, namely, what are the current tools that we use to engage with one another, and what is the story that's being told? And when it comes to emerging markets, it's deeply important that we understand their stories. And as Scott Macklin, the speaker just before me, asked us to remember in his last lecture, we also need to ask the question, what does the story serve, and who does the story serve? So tonight, I want to illustrate three overarching storylines that I think should shape our understanding of emerging markets. But before we go there, I want to first spend a little bit of time on the term emerging markets. I'll start with a question for all of you. When I say emerging markets, what do you think of? What comes to mind? I'm sorry? Africa. Third world. India. You're good. There's no question that the term emerging markets was born out of the business world. Just the word markets is a dead giveaway, yeah? The problem is many markets have already emerged significantly, and the rules of engagement aren't always about bottom line issues. For some, and one of you echoed this, the phrase emerging markets is another way of saying the developing world. And it's a bit of a lightning rod, the developing world, because terms like emerging markets and the developing world's third world country, they are typically dreamed up by folks who don't actually live there, but just report about them. Take my friend's father, for instance. He is one of the most well-respected scientists in India, and he's a head researcher at an eye institute, and he's been the equivalent of knighted by the Indian government. He's in demand internationally for speaking lectures, and his eye institute in India that he's in charge of research, it sees patients from all over the world, not just because what they can offer there is on a scale sometimes cheaper than the home countries, but because they offer superlative care. They have top-class trained eye physicians there, and this has become a magnet eye institute. And Dr. B and I were having a conversation once about this term, the developing world. And he said to me with a twinkle in his eye, "Amita, we used to be the developed world," referring to India. And I take his point. Many of the countries we associate with emerging markets are really re-emerging, if you think about it. So like many stock phrases that saturate these conversations, these are imperfect ones. I admit to that. But for tonight's purposes, I'm going to stick with emerging markets, but I do look forward to the arrival of new alternatives. So now, back to tonight's three storylines. The first one, emerging markets are not monolithic. For example, Brazil, Pakistan, Thailand, they don't jump out as having much in common on the surface. But countries as different as these three are often lumped together in when using the broadly defined term emerging markets. In this case, in the slide, the emerging markets are demonstrated by blue colors. Some would suggest that what binds many emerging markets together is not necessarily what they have in common superficially, but is instead their relationship with wealthy countries. That's what binds them together as emerging markets. I think this is useful just to a point, but still oversimplifies the diversity of countries considered to be quote-unquote emerging. So that's my first storyline, but they're not monolithic. Storyline number two, customers in emerging markets are now colleagues and becoming competition. When the phrase emerging markets first appeared, it was often in this clever turn of phrase, what the West can provide the rest. This refers to products, especially new technologies, and it was pretty one-directional when it came to technology. The West had the products, the rest were untapped customers. This is changing as these markets mature. It's no longer universally this one-way model. Certain countries are now producing technology that they once had to import. Western companies are setting up satellite offices and they're hiring local talent. And that's the part about colleagues that I refer to, growing number of colleagues. But beyond all that, the most recent trend is homegrown production capacity, which is here where the notion of competition comes in. And that's the trend, then that's definitely a trend that's going to continue, and for reasons we're going to talk about later tonight. So that's number two. On to number three, by and large, emerging markets have populations with what we're going to call a substantial relational generation. Many of you who braved the snowstorm for the night that David Domke spoke here, when he presented the second talk of the series, you'll remember that he described the difference between the dutiful generation here in the United States and the relational generation. And even though his talk was specific to this country, I'm going to suggest tonight that many of the attributes that he associated with the relational generation have huge relevance in emerging markets. Why? Because by and large, emerging market countries are demographically young. In some cases, overwhelmingly so. So now, let's return to the first storyline. Emerging markets are not monolithic. As I said earlier, there's always a risk when, for expedience's sake, you create terms like emerging markets that encompass such a broad array of countries. When you have something that puts economic heavyweights like Russia and China by comparison, economic lightweights, maybe a Peru or a Kenya in the same family, you need a little bit more detail. So let's start with some of the giants in the field. Show of hands, how many of you have heard of the term BRIC countries? Good. Can anyone name them? All right, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, excellent. These are considered the four powerhouses within the emerging markets family. The Huffington Post recently published a list of the top 11 countries in terms of internet use per month, average internet use per month. And all four of the BRIC countries ranked. India came in at number 11 with an average of 11 hours a month. China at number 10 with 13. Russia came in at number 8 with 21 hours. And then there's Brazil, number 6 with 25 hours. And you'll notice that that puts Brazil ahead of Germany and Japan. And the United States? Number 2. Any guesses as to who's at the top? Oh, what? South Korea? No. France? No. Our neighbors to the north. Canada, 43 hours. So this shows that the BRIC countries are playing in that online space. So let's look at each of them specifically, and we're going to start with China. I had an opportunity to live in China for a summer in 1987, which, given China's economic development since then, might as well have been 1887. I was in Beijing. There were no buildings in the city that were over 3 stories tall except one, the Friendship Hotel, which is unimaginable today compared to the soaring skyscrapers and the soaring skyline that you see in Beijing today. Bicyclists ruled the city, flotillas of them throughout the city. And for anyone that's been to Beijing, you know it's a biker's paradise because it's flat as a pancake. But it's not a biker's paradise any longer. Bikes have been squeezed out to the point where they're almost a quaint memory. And I received an email from friends of mine who are living there now, and they and their family live in Beijing, and the husband and wife, and they work on opposite ends of the city, and they decided the other day that they wanted to meet in the middle, in the center of the city for lunch. And they both actually happened to bike. So they decided to bike to the center of the city, to Tiananmen, and have lunch. And Don wrote me and said that people were gawking at them because they had bikes in the center of the city. So now you've seen bicyclists go from being the primary mode of transportation in a city to a novelty. In 1987, when I was there for the summer, I was told that there were only 1,300 privately owned vehicles in the city of Beijing. 1,300. Last year, 13.6 million vehicles were sold in China, the first time it overtook the United States in terms of total number of vehicles sold. Any guesses what this number is? What it represents? Don't be shy. Cell phones. Excellent. 860 million cell phones are in use in China, more than any other country in the world. And I read recently that there is a cell carrier in China that announced it processes 1.6 billion text messages a day. That's more than one text message for every citizen in China. And that's just one telecommunications company, cell company. China is an example of a country that has woke up from an economic slumber and rapidly modernized. And this has created demand for natural resources that has made them very eager investors, more and more in the United States, but on the African continent as well. You want to know where I had the best Chinese banquet of my life? Wasn't Shanghai, wasn't Hong Kong, wasn't Beijing, and I've had great meals in all three of those cities. No, the best Chinese banquet I've ever eaten was in the capital of Sudan, Khartoum. You see, China has been cultivating a relationship with Sudan since before I was born. In the early 60s, the bamboo curtain was up pretty squarely between China and the West. And so part of Chairman Mao's foreign policy was to befriend leaders, and many of those leaders who were sympathetic to his rule, and many of those leaders were in African nations. And what's interesting is that this was, in the case of Sudan, years before the oil that was eventually discovered, that was eventually very desirable on the part of China. So what you have now is a situation where those original relationships that were cultivated in the early 60s were really to feed China's ego. And now those relationships are feeding its growing fossil fuel addiction. I've been in airports in Ethiopia, in Namibia, in Sudan, where I hear Mandarin swirling around me because of the staggering numbers of expat Chinese who are part of either resource extraction or infrastructure projects in the African capital. The strategic relationships have really begun to bear fruit. And why do I mention this? Because the strategic alliances have an impact on innovation as it moves between China and their network of partner countries. So next up, India. There's some striking parallels between India and China. First, their enormous population. India is actually on pace to overtake China by 2050 when it's predicted that their population is actually going to hit, it's going to exceed 1.6 billion. I think by 2050 they're saying it's going to be 1.63 billion, something like that. In addition, both countries, China and India, have a growing middle class, as well as a commitment to building local innovation hubs. India is one of the first countries where I experienced the incredible growth, but also accessibility of new media technology, specifically mobile cell phones. It was in 2003, and I was a relatively new cell phone user when I first visited India, and I assumed that when I landed, it was going to be a somewhat laborious process to get myself an Indian SIM card and get started and having cell phone connectivity. Well, it took me all of 10 minutes, and it cost me about $10. And there's one person in particular to thank for this bargain, and he's not even Indian. He's currently the richest man in the world, and his name is Carlos Slim. He's Mexican. And when the cell phone craze started towards the end of the 90s, he was already, by any measurement, a very wealthy and influential businessman in Mexico who had made quite a killing by being involved in the landline telecommunications industry. And so when the cell companies from North America, from Canada and from the United States started coming down into Mexico with their with the plans that you and I might be more familiar with, high startup costs, multi-year contracts, the prescribed minutes allocation, monthly fees, they came down and were trying to sell this kind of blueprint to Mexico. And Carlos Slim took one look at the model and said, "You're crazy. This is never going to work here." And what Slim understood is that given the large percentage of Mexico who are part of the cash-based economy, he knew that there was no way that people from that cash-based economy would pay that much money up front to commit for that much time, given the steep monthly fees and the relative high barrier to entry. They just couldn't count on that kind of revenue stream. So Slim said, look, if you lower the costs and allow subscribers to get a SIM card for relatively cheap and then buy minutes incrementally for a small fee when they need them, then you've got a business model that's going to work. So the concept of top-up cards was born. Think pay-as-you-go. And Slim was right. Today, the majority of emerging markets operate on this top-up card system. There's a low cost for entry and cheap ways to buy more minutes. In fact, many top-up cards, you couldn't even call them cards anymore. They're little strips of paper that just have the value that you've purchased and a little scratch-off on the back, no bigger than the size of my finger. And you scratch off the code, you enter it into your cell phone, and voila, you've got more minutes in just seconds. No more of this steep fees because you've gone over your allocation of minutes. That is a pain that I'm sure many of us have experienced here. In India, you can buy minutes for spare change. And since most countries, you only pay for outgoing minutes, the minutes tend to last longer. In this country, most of us pay for the minutes that come in and the minutes that go out. That is absolutely not the model in most of the world. In fact, some countries even have what I call a 21st century Morse code, like Ghana, where instead of actually using their minutes, they will have this they call it flashing, where they will call and hang up, and two hang-ups means pick me up, or three hang-ups means don't bother. And it's a way of saving minutes, but then using these very creative ways to communicate in what I say is almost like a Morse code. I've been back to India three times since 2003, and my routine has been pretty much the same. I land, I find a kiosk, I get a SIM card, and in fact, the last two times, I've been even able to use the SIM card that I had from the previous trip. It's perfect. It's like a fly in amber. It doesn't change. My balance stays exactly the same. I take it out when I leave. I put it back in when I get to India. Couldn't be easier. And I think that even though there's been a level of formalization that's been introduced in India because, because of the 2008 Mumbai bombings, where they really wanted to make sure that people had names associated with the SIM card registrations, even despite that formalization, I still maintain that the key characteristics of cell telecommunications in India are that they're flexible, they're affordable, and by and large, it's very good service. I don't get many dropped calls when I'm in India. So two more countries to go on our brick wall. We're going to go on to Russia. Now, while Russia doesn't share the population growth issues that China and India are having to battle, and battling in very different ways, it has seen spectacular growth when it comes to personal wealth since the fall of the Soviet Union, and much of that is driven by their gas and their oil deposits. There are currently, according to the Forbes annual list of the richest people in the world, Moscow is home to the highest number of billionaires in the world, 79. Now, when I first went to the Soviet Union in 1991, it was still the Soviet Union in 1991, the ruble was in free fall. I could buy a five-course meal for about 25 cents. And 20 years later, they've got 79 of the world's billionaires. And as a side note, China doubled the number of billionaires from 2009 to 2010, and Brazil has increased by two-thirds. And if you take the BRIC countries in total, they are responsible for more than half of the 214 new billionaires worldwide in that 12-month period, 2009 to 2010. So with that wealth comes the ability to put disposable income toward products, and adoption rates for new technologies in Russia are high. And they're actually high in both the urban and the rural areas. That's not necessarily true of all emerging markets. There are some countries where you see much higher rates of penetration in the urban areas. Russia, interestingly, has quite a bit of use in the rural areas as well. Like China, Russia still maintains very serious state control over media in general, but that doesn't mean that the state isn't playing in the new media sphere. In fact, in 2009, a Kremlin-based think tank launched a training center called, quote, the Kremlin School of Bloggers. So it's not just, quote, the people that are playing and using social media, playing in the internet space and using social media, it's also the politicians. Take this for instance. Let's move on to Brazil, our final BRIC country. So while Brazil is ranked sixth in internet use, according to the Huffington Post list that we saw earlier, what are Brazilians doing online? This 8.8% represents that Brazil accounts for 8.8% of all Twitter users in the world, trailing only the United States. And that number is expected to grow. Last fall, I taught a class at the MCDM called Emerging Markets and Digital Media, and I was lucky enough to have two Brazilian students in my class. And as you all may remember, Brazil had a national election last fall, and my students were very eager to share the kind of use that politicians and the political candidates were making of Twitter and the kind of conversations happening on Twitter. Now, let's be fair. This is still a very small segment of the population who utilize Twitter as a way to gain information around voting trends or information about politicians, but it's certainly something that is going to expand. It's going to grow as Brazil continues in their rise in connectivity. And let's also not forget to look at who was the winner of that election. You have Dilma Vana Rousseff, the first female head of state ever elected in Brazil, and an economist to boot. Now that's progress no matter what country you're talking about. Now there's no question that the BRIC countries have had some substantial advantages, I would say, in terms of spurred growth and success in new media, whether it's their access to resources, certain government structures or governance structures, certain leadership structures. And so they claim a lot of the spotlight, it's true. And that's why there's an acronym for them. But new media success is not limited to these countries alone. So let's now move to an example from Kenya. I think Kenya has, it's safe to say, the most successful phone-to-phone money transfer system in the world. It's called M-Pesa. And it was founded in 2007 as an international partnership that involved both the public and the private sector. But I'm going to suggest tonight that I think one of the reasons it's been so successful is the key Kenyans at leadership positions at all levels of M-Pesa. Last year, the equivalent of $650 million was transferred by simple text messages between, for the most part, very basic phones in Kenya. This is not a country that's saturated with smartphones. And the average transaction, $33. So that's a lot of money going back and forth on phones. So why such a demand in Kenya for this money transfer system? Well, to start, you have an outdated banking system that can pose serious bureaucratic challenges if you're trying to move money. You can wait in line for hours. It might take days for the transfer to take place. And it's just a hassle. So you've got that demand there. But like many emerging markets and like many countries worldwide, Kenya is rapidly urbanizing. And you see more youth moving from rural areas to the cities for higher wages, but there's a demand for them to send some of those wages back to families that they've left behind. And in the past, not only were they facing bureaucratic challenges on the upfront in the urban areas, but their families back in the rural villages might have to travel a day or more to get to the nearest branch of a bank to then pick up the transfer. So this really expedited the process in a very elegant way. And the mobile phone was able to replace something that would have taken days or more to happen. So it really filled that need. But in addition, I think one of the other key successes of M-Pesa is that It tapped into small-scale vendors in the rural areas to act as the banks. The vendors would apply to be an official M-Pesa vendor, and they do the job of actually dispensing the money. It's a very sophisticated process, and it's also an incredibly clever way to tap into an existing resource instead of just reinventing the wheel. And you see these kinds of innovations all over the world. And I believe that one of the key ingredients to this kind of resourceful design around new technologies is because, in the case of cell phones, they didn't replace a landline culture the way that they did in this country. And in many emerging market countries, mobile, they're the first widespread option for connectivity. And I think, therefore, the populations are more creative in how they leverage the technology because they're not stuck with old assumptions of use. Case in point, one night I was watching Monday Night Football, and up came a commercial showing a man checking his bank balance on a cell phone. And there was a proud voiceover in the commercial. At Bank of America, you can even check your balance on a cell phone. I thought, check your balance? Compare this to Kenya, where they're not just checking balances, they're moving $650 million in a year. Who looks like a developing country now? This kind of innovation drives the second storyline tonight. Customers in emerging markets are now colleagues and competition. So let's stick with Kenya. I want to relate a story about an influential blog called, it goes by the name White African, which is curated by Eric Hirschman, who was raised in Sudan and Kenya, and is seen as really a human bridge between Silicon Valley and the African continent. No pressure for him. He's got that kind of influence. And he's the founder of a Nairobi-based effort called iHub, that is an innovation hub only about a year old that is at this point, according to White African, got about 3,000 Kenyan technologists, developers, designers, and entrepreneurs who get together and interact and collaborate. And this is just in one country, in one year. So back in December, Hirschman published a blog post about one of the key ingredients to successful new media innovations when it comes to the African continent. And he wrote this on his blog. Almost any meaningful success in Africa's mobile or web space has been from companies focused on meeting the needs of ordinary people. Even though Hirschman's entry was specific to Africa, I think it also rings true for emerging markets more broadly. Think back to Carlos Slim and top-up cards. He had a vision of technology that was accessible to ordinary people. Or M-Pesa, certainly a technology that is overwhelmingly used by regular Kenyans. But just because you're targeting ordinary people doesn't mean that the technology can't have an extraordinary effect on their lives. To start, people use and value new technologies for the very same reason that many of us do in this room. They connect us to our family and our friends. But having said that, more and more innovations have a quote-unquote social good element, whether it's text message programs that help farmers with agricultural tips, geo-visualization mapping that tracks disease outbreaks like what we saw in Haiti, or cash cards that encourage savings and financial security. And why might this social good element be? Well, let's ask the question, who exactly is driving this innovation? Well, the answer brings us to our third storyline, that emerging markets and emerging market countries have populations with a significantly large relational generation. So for you, for those of you that were snowbound on David's talk, second one, I'm going to do a little bit of a recap. David talked to us about the dutiful versus the relational generation. The dutiful generation sees civic engagement as obligatory. They express their commitment to civic life through formal acts, like voting. They tend to receive media. And when he said receive media, David was talking about receiving the paper that comes at the same time every day. You absorb and you take in. And they tend to express it through, they're joiners and they want security. That's the dutiful generation. The relational generation, by contrast, are much more selective about civic engagement. They express it through informal, everyday acts. They tend to navigate media. They tend to absorb it at many different times, not in a finite, specific way. And they tend to choose networking over joining. And they want that go big or go home, that epicness, which I think actually feeds right into the idea of social good. Now, furthermore, because of their higher rate of adopting technology, David suggested that this generation has an expanded definition of community. Because they can link to their online peers across the city, across the country, or across many, many continents. And they really want to make a difference, both locally, in their communities, and on a more widespread scale. Remember the epic nature. And this relational generation is a generation of risk takers and entrepreneurs, and I believe that these characteristics can be applied to their peers in emerging markets. But here's the interesting distinction between the relational generation of the United States and versus emerging markets. In the United States, we've got a low growth rate. I think out of the 230 possible countries, we're at about 203. We're an aging country. But by and large, emerging markets have significantly young populations that are entering the workforce in droves. And the circumstance is often referred to as a demographic dividend. When economic growth increases, because the size of an eligible workforce increases. Take Turkey, for example. Turkey has a median age of 29 years. By comparison, the median age in the United States is about 36 and will continue to rise. And according to a UN Development Index report from 2008-2009, Turkey has 12 million youth between the age of 15 and 24 who are going to be entering the workforce in the next 5 years. That's a staggering number of people. And for this reason, Turkey is emphasizing new job creation in the tech and telecom industries. These are fast-growing and often very entrepreneurial, which appeals to the relational generation. There's one large exception to this trend within emerging markets, and that trend is China, or that exception is China. Due to their one-child policy, China is looking at a rapidly aging population. Have some of you heard the phrase, China's trying to get rich before it gets old? They're the outlier, for sure, within emerging markets, but still worth mentioning. Now, a young population alone does not mean success. Certain stars must align in governance, education, access to technologies, and employment opportunities. Countries that are home to a large youth population that have limited job opportunities and find themselves in challenging situations where they either have millions of underemployed or unemployed youth are going to face challenges. Some of these youth are educated, some of them are not, and if there are no jobs to focus their talents, then unrest can occur, and it doesn't always end up like Egypt or Tunisia in this slide, which I would also say is a story that is far from over. I think the really hard work has just begun in those countries. At Hansen's opening talk in this series, he described the story of the vegetable seller who set himself on fire in Tunisia, who is credited with inspiring Tunisia's Jasmine Revolution. And I would say that social media can create a larger megaphone, but it's the convergence of on-the-ground work, sacrifice, and technology that creates that combustion for revolution. Before closing and getting to the Q&A, because I'm very interested in your inputs, I want to draw attention to a couple of the books that helped inform this talk. And there are actually many, but there are three in particular that I want to mention today. To start, anybody who is interested in a new take on China should read Adam Siegel's Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. Siegel's based at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York City, and he's written a real antidote for the dominant refrain we've heard for many years that China and its army of engineers are taking over the innovation landscape. So it's a very refreshing and very well-informed and well-researched read. That's the first one. Second is Evgeny Morozov's book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. And he takes what Morozov's doing in this book is he takes a critical look at the cyber utopians, quote unquote, when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, and a more critical look at social media as a change agent in emerging markets. He actually spoke last night. Was anyone there at the World Affairs Council event? He actually spoke last night presenting this book with the World Affairs Council, and KOW recorded it, so it will probably air, oh, I don't know, sometime in the next couple months. And it would be well worth a listen because he is asking some really interesting and I think very thought-provoking questions about perhaps the exaggerated positive emphasis that we place upon new media for regime change. So that's the second one. And finally, for more insights into notions of entrepreneurship and the demographic dividend, I can't recommend enough Young World Rising, How Youth Technology and Entrepreneurship Are Changing the World from the Bottom Up. This is written by Seattle's own Rob Salkowitz here in the audience tonight. Make yourself known, Rob, so that people can approach you. This is a wonderful book that has a tremendous number of case studies that will continue to whet your appetite and spur your imagination for understanding how this I think, wonderfully synergistic combination of young entrepreneurs and access to certain technologies and certain conditions on the ground can have a wonderful effect. So tonight I propose three storylines related to engagement intelligence around emerging markets, that they are diverse, they are innovating, and that they are young. In closing, I want to return to Hansen's suggestion from the first lecture that in this media-rich age, the storytelling uprising is really about new channels, new scope, and new communities. This has never been more true in emerging markets. Where there was a lack of technologies, there is now the fastest growth rate of adoption. Where horizons were limited, they've now been broadened. And where there are boundaries, there are now more options for bridges. The story of emerging markets has not yet been finished, but more and more, they are the ones telling it. Thank you very much. Questions? Now we get to the fun part. Or comments? Why so shy? Yes.
Well, it seems like in the time that this course has been going on, we've seen some really compelling examples of change and lack of change and fluctuation that is kind of concurrent with having all this access to the media and all this activity. So I'm thinking, for instance, I mean, the obvious examples of all the different countries in Africa, the Middle East, but even like going down to Ivory Coast, mm-hmm. what's going on there. So we see this kind of a lot of talk about how there's so much more information, so much that China has clamped down on its dissidents at the same time. They just directed that artist mm-hmm. who has, you know, a really global profile constituency. And I guess I'm just curious about kind of your take, as I've been on everyone's take. I have, how is this playing out to kind of on that idea of whether
it's a big question. It's a good question, and I think it also relates to the idea of it's a tool, first and foremost. And I think one of the things that Morozov's getting at is that we sometimes are quick to whether exaggerate its capabilities, but also to make it something that it's not. And what we've seen, I think, in many emerging markets is that there are abundance of examples where it's giveth, I think, especially when you start to incorporate that idea of the social good, where there are opportunities for it to really make a difference. However, there was a recent blog post by Kentaro Yoyama, who used to be at Microsoft Research and is now down at UC Berkeley, and he wrote a very compelling blog post that was entitled, Technology is Not the Answer. And he'd done years of work, specifically in India, seeding some entrepreneurial and often very community-based projects that that twinned technology and social good projects. And his thesis in the blog post was that it didn't come down to the technology, it came down to the people. And whether they were motivated, whether they were committed to the project, and that was really the key to success. It wasn't the shiny new toy, it was the human capacity. And he's come forward, he had four subsequent blog posts for that. He was a guest blog poster for 5 days on The Atlantic. And I think he's come up with if I recall correctly, it's a formula that intent and capacity, virtue equals intent plus capacity. So he's really pushing to think about not the technology so much, but the people using it and what are their motivations and how prepared are they to make it work in their particular cultural context in a way that is useful to them. And I think in many emerging market situations, especially maybe 5-10 years ago, when it was just really starting to see that expectation of how might technology better people's lives, there can be a lot of assumptions made about what somebody needs and to what extent do you really engage with that community and ask them, what is it that you're trying to solve or how might this help? And are we placing unfair expectations on what a cell phone can do? In my class, for instance, we talk about the emotional versus the economic value of a cell phone. There was a case where young mothers in Uganda were, which by the way I've been to, and I had better cell phone coverage in rural Uganda than I do in Fremont here in Seattle. And there was a case study in Uganda of women who were foregoing food in order to buy more minutes for their cell phone. And some reactions were, what is this, keeping up with the Joneses? Are they not taking care of their kids? But let's think about that for a minute. It could be a security thing. Having a cell phone allows them to feel more connected or protected. So we have to be very careful about assumptions we make around why someone would opt to have more minutes. It might not just be that they're playing the Ugandan version of Angry Birds. It might be that they actually have a deeper reason why they will want to have more minutes. But we do tend to make assumptions. But at the end of the day, as I said earlier, people like cell phone technology because it connects them to friends and family. They can check the football scores. In some cases, it absolutely has a transformational change in their business or their livelihood. And you don't want to discount that. And I never would. But I also think we need to be realistic about the fact that it is a tool, and it's sometimes a really fun tool or just a very useful tool. And there are other opportunities for it to be something more than that. But it isn't. That's not a given. Does that make sense? Is that helpful? Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question the question was about does something like cell phone technology have a way of either reducing inequalities or exacerbating or growing inequalities? I mean, there are a couple different ways that I could take apart that question and answer it. So bear with me as I think about a couple of them. On the one hand, I mentioned the fact that China and India have these rapidly growing middle classes. And as part of that middle class growth is the acquisition of things. It's consumerism. You see the malls and you have a disposable income. You can purchase things. And so you could make the argument that if you take away, if we just put the functionality of a cell phone to the side and we just see it as a product, as something that we purchase, and as the cell phone technology becomes more sophisticated in countries all around the world, because it's not as if emerging markets are only using the very basic bare-bones cell phones. Smartphones are making inroads all over the place. It's not to the same percentage that it is in other countries, but it's getting there. And so you're starting to see people coveting something like a cell phone that creates a certain status symbol, or there's that element of cachet, or they've got connectivity. And so from that perspective, you can make the argument that it is something that distinguishes people from one another. And it's a product, and it's something that people can pursue or save for, especially if they see beyond just, as I mentioned earlier, even though it's often a social tool for connectivity, there's no question that in some cases it can be a boon to someone's productivity in certain situations. And you could argue that a good example of perhaps a leveling or a shrinking of not status per se, but you hear a number of situations in many different countries where cell phones have enabled small-scale business people to cut out middlemen so that there's a way for them to leapfrog over what has traditionally been a longer necklace of connections between them as a producer and the consumers that could be villages, miles, countries away. So you could argue that that kind of technology creates a collapse in a good, and I say when I say collapse, I mean this in a good way, that it collapses their distance to information that allows them to actually be more savvy and in the long run, perhaps even more successful in terms of their earnings. So that is one example. Now in terms of, what's that? No, well, well, and you're absolutely right that even though I gave the example of the middle class rise in a place like India or China, it's also fair to say that the gap between the haves and the have-nots is getting much, much wider. And so, yes, you might have 79 billionaires in Moscow, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's equitable. In fact, it's probably a great example. I mean, that's it's not equitable. Correct. Yeah. But, yeah. So that excellent dovetail off of that. Was that a helpful answer? Okay. Over red, red, blue. Please. I'll go in that.
I'm wondering if in your travels and experiences, you've seen any interesting
ways that some of the emerging market countries are integrating technology into classrooms?
Mm-hmm. And how
does
that differ than, say, what we're doing here, or anything that tends to be successful
for certain countries? Yeah. That's a really good question. I have to give you a little disclaimer that the classroom experience is not one that I know a lot about. I haven't actually been in many classrooms, at least I'm thinking like K-12 level, is that probably what you're interested in? But I can give some anecdotal stuff that gets talked about quite a bit. There have been studies that are and projects that have looked at introducing technology in a way that is what they say tropically tolerant. So many of the emerging markets have somewhat inhospitable conditions. Not that there's a low or limited access to power or to electricity. So you want to create tropically tolerant technologies that can go into classrooms and can actually improve learning and student learning. And I think it's been a very tough nut to crack. The earlier poster child for technology into classrooms was one laptop per child. Have people heard of that project? It's the happy little green laptops that were going to sell for about $100. They came out of a collaboration at MIT, and the idea was we're going to create this accessible, durable, very highly functional, very nimble laptop, and this is going to allow widespread connectivity to take place in many countries that wouldn't otherwise have opportunities. And I think that now that one laptop per child has been investing in countries for quite some time, the critics are clamoring because there's a very strong sense that the laptop in a classroom, when you don't have, again, this gets back to what Yoyama's talking about, the human capacity around who is going to fix that laptop when it breaks? Do the teachers have training in these laptops before they are able to introduce them to their students? How is it going to work when the one laptop per child team leaves the classroom and goes very, very, very far away? Are they just going to end up in a situation where they're frustrated because the minute one thing goes wrong, they find themselves in a tough situation? And so that's one example that I think the bloom has been off the rose of one laptop per child. Now, that's not the only project that's out there. And I know that there have been And these are this is trending towards the more creative, everything from digital storytelling initiatives. There's a local organization here in Seattle called Bridges to Understanding that's done digital storytelling swaps between classrooms here in the Seattle area and classrooms in emerging markets. That's a whole other direction of using and leveraging technology. This gets to what Scott was talking about, too, allowing communities to tell their stories, but then using it as an educational tool between classrooms. So that's another spoke, I would say, of the educational wheel. You've also got laptops that have one monitor and multiple mice, so that you're when you're in more densely populated areas or classrooms where you've got 50, 60 students, you don't have to have a laptop per child, but they can all collaborate on a single monitor using this split mouse. And so there have been researchers here at the University of Washington with the Technology and Social Change Group who have done some interesting studies looking at, does that split mouse encourage student learning? Because there are some arguments that say from a pedagogical standpoint, it gets four people working together. And so they help one another out, and there's more learning. And then there are others who say, well, but it encourages a certain level of competition that actually doesn't aid student learning. So I don't think that the results are conclusive. And those are just a couple examples. But there's certainly that's a very popular space to be working because it's seen as not. I mean, if you have success, it's a high impact on the future. But it's been, again, this gets back to those more overarching themes that I would say Kentaro Yoyama really hit in his blog, that technology is not the answer. It's the will on the ground and the human capacity. Yes, sir. Which one? The one, the 860 million with China, yes. Right.
And even in India, then it starts tending to be trilingual, which is nothing. If you know Hindi, you know English, and you know what both languages.
Right.
And then China tends to be traditional Chinese, and then not your own Chinese tends to be so much.
Well, and that's an excellent question, and one that is, as you see the emergence and the introduction of smartphones that have less flexible browsers, to what extent is that going to then either, as you say, force people to operate in a language that may not be their first language or maybe an adopted language, or do you see an opportunity here for platforms, and there's definitely some experimentation here where you can allow societies to adapt platforms in order to amend them and adjust them to reflect their local language. And I think that's really going to be the future. Obviously, it's not that, I think that English is not fast, I mean it has, because of the dominance of many of the platforms that operate in that language, I'm not suggesting that it's soon to disappear, but I do think, and this gets back to the idea of indigenous local innovations, as you see, I think, this rise in saying, wouldn't it be nice if we had phones that actually operated off of the platform of the language that I spoke? And many phones do. I mean, we know that even on voice phones, sometimes when I would pick up a cell phone in Sudan, I'd have to fiddle around with it to get the Arabic off the front because I had to pull it back into its English interface. But so there's a tremendous amount of flexibility in terms of phones and what language they use. But your question is well taken, which is, I think what you were asking, or correct me if I'm wrong, that idea that to what extent does the platform drive a social norm in the sense that does that determine the kind of language that people have to engage with the technology, or can the reverse happen where the innovators drive the language such that it is more appropriate for the particular cultural context where it's being sold? Is that fair? Yeah.
I'm looking for, are there people who are actually creating new ways to
And they're and then they're just being honest. Do you know of any, Rob? Please, add.
One of the things that's making it easier, because localization into what they call third-tier languages, which is some of the Indian local languages and things like that, by hundreds of languages, but, you know, they're not considered primary targets for translation because the people who speak them don't have much money. But this new thing around cloud computing is creating, instead of everybody having their own system, server and sending out their data, it's all being aggregated into one place. And it makes a lot more sense to sell localization to one buyer, to the cloud provider, and they localize everything on the cloud into these languages, and it's making it a lot more acceptable. Just starting to see this as this model is coming out, but I think this is what's going to change in the next 5 years or so, because the economics are changing. It makes it profitable.
What are there, 15 national languages in India, I think? Something like that. There was a question here, and then we'll go to the back.
Yeah, I recently heard that Ethan Moyo, the economist, who was originally from Zambia, but was educated at Oxford, was just an incredible person. And she wrote a book called, the first book she wrote that I know of was Dead Aid. Other parts of the world, economic markets, we are not participating in them as Americans at our peril. And she believes that one of the things we as Americans have to do is begin to participate in these emerging markets as opposed to focusing on real estate. But the reason I bring that up is I feel like in a way she's given a parallel talk about emerging markets. And I feel like, I mean, I could be wrong, but I have the sense that many, many Americans no idea that what's going on and how much the rest of the world is permeated by technology. But I'm just wondering, at what peril is that business ignorance? I mean, like, we're not playing with the rest of the world in a way in this new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, at what peril are we not? Or am I wrong? Maybe we're playing a lot more than I realize.
Well, I guess I would answer that question in a number of ways. Okay, so the question is about it was building off of a book that was written by an author by the name of Gambisa Moyo. The first book she wrote was Dead Aid, and the second book she wrote was How the West Was Lost. And the question is about to what extent are we, meaning the United States, at our own peril, not engaging with emerging markets? And I know that I'm oversimplifying your question, but and it's interesting because my first reaction, being the daughter of two historians, is to start to go back and talk about the founding of this country and the fact that you have to remember that I'm not talking about the natives, but the earliest settlers of this country wanted to be left alone. They had no interest in the rest of the world, and they were fleeing persecution. And so I think that even though we share our borders, there's a very island mentality about the United States, isolationist about the states. Now, having said that, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we're not engaging in emerging markets. I think we are, and I know we are. But at the same time, you're asking a question that it really depends on the sector, the industry, the people. I mean, you'd be talking about this from a personal perspective, or you could be talking about this from an industry perspective. And that's where there are many distinctions, because on the one hand, and this gets to larger questions about that I was talking about with Morozov last night, there is, let's just talk about technology for a minute and the expectation around to what extent does that open us up to a diversity of opinions. You have the discourse that says, technology is magical because at our fingertips exists this diversity of opinions. And you could argue that this diversity of opinions goes well beyond our own national borders. We are able to pull in information from all over the place to expand our own understanding of the world and our own thinking. But the flip side to that, the contrarians to that particular argument say, but no, the internet is not magical in the way that it exposes us to the diversity of opinions. It allows us to fall down these rabbit holes of people that see the world as we do. And that allows us to play in a much more myopic space with people who agree with us. And I raise this simply because I think that to the extent that each individual educates themselves about what's happening in the rest of the world, that's partly what you're getting at. But when it comes to whether it's the United States foreign policymakers, and to what extent do they have influence, and to what extent do they leverage technology, or to what extent, and that's what Morozov's talking about in the Net Delusion, to what extent do they see internet technology as a silver bullet as opposed to something that is used for more nefarious purposes, that really requires some rigor. And also, we talked about this earlier in the talk, the idea that emerging markets built out of a capitalist structure, there are bottom line issues that are involved here, and so the other question to ask is, is our engagement around the transaction of goods, or is our engagement going to go beyond that? And how does it go beyond that, and to what extent? So that's partly how I would answer that. Is that helpful? There was a man in the back, and then over.
One real quick question.
Please.
With the top-up cards,
mm-hmm.
obviously you put more minutes on it, but if texting is such a big deal, how do they do that? Are you charged per text?
Very similar, yes, where you are charged a certain amount per text, and every plan is a little different, but it would just still deplete your account accordingly. In fact, some cases, texting is even much cheaper. So you actually see very robust texting societies where a phone call is even more unusual. People don't even have their voicemail boxes set up because it's really a text-based culture.
Then I think this goes along with that question, but if you were in one of the great countries,
mm-hmm.
And you looked back to the United States,
mm-hmm.
not an emerging market,
mm-hmm.
how do those great countries see us as a market?
Oh, interesting. How do they see us as a market? Well, each country is a little different, but let's take China, for instance. I mean, the market for China, you walk into a Walmart and, I mean, how many, I'm probably wearing things that were made in China. So the market is for everything from T-shirts to clothes to televisions. I mean, you just look down at the port of Seattle and you see the containers that are coming off the ships. And so when you take the C and the brick, China, that's the market. But each of the BRICS, I would say, it depends on what are their natural resources, what are their comparative advantages when it comes to what we need. And so many of them, while what's being transactioned, there's not a parity necessarily, it depends on what their particular natural resources, not just natural resources, but what are they producing. And in the case that I just gave of China, it's the spectrum now. Does that make sense? No, go ahead.
Well, surely we're probably all working in China.
Right. I probably am. I know my shows are.
China, those markets that you, I like the term re-emerging, they were once re-emerging. And yet, when you look at us, we're really kind of going in the other direction.
In the sense that?
In the sense that we have an older population.
Okay.
We don't manufacture stuff. All of that sort of thing. So when you
I hear what you're getting at, and I think that there is a large sense of possibility that, and I'm not even talking about specifically the BRIC countries, but they're good examples where there is this growing sense of how can we now expand our reach, and how can we now get into the game of exports in a way that's going to grow our economy, so that this gets down to the second storyline, the idea of customers only no longer, colleagues and producers, and the idea of that production growing economies and allowing for emerging markets to see themselves as actually playing in the marketplace, in the global marketplace. Absolutely. Yeah. Please.
I mean, there was a concept of better lifestyle and so on, but the flip side is, well, are they really as hard working as they actually just do But even now, given all this, when you go to China, the car alone is a Buick LaCrosse. And it's an SUV. I have not seen a Buick SUV in the U.S. but you go to China, that's the car it owns. I mean, all my friends who are MBAs who are Chinese bankers, they go and they pick me up. Buick SUV, they never drive their cars. And they want to spend this more money than the Mercedes SUV, but they never drive it. It's always driver. In India, the same thing. Do that. But when you start looking at rich media, they're still in exciting spaces. Is what Hollywood is coming up with, what Pixar is coming up with, what these storytelling style where art and technology mix up and create these new businesses that is just so rich in terms of dimensionality. That is still very American. Even though the people bringing it up is from all over the world, it's still seen as an American trait coming from there. And that is something that I think is lovelier in all the learning of this.
And I think you're right. There is a mythic quality in some ways of what does the United States embody, whether it's the open road and the car and on it goes, or Hollywood. Absolutely, the depth of research is there, and the online communities are, I think, allowing for that research to be much more integrated now, cross nationally. With where you see scientists working in a way in a connective way that was almost unimaginable 15, 20 years ago, but the resources that now allow them to collaborate in a more real-time way and across national ways is quite staggering. So, point very well taken. I don't mean to suggest that emerging markets don't look to the West with not just a curiosity but a real fascination. But by the same token, I've also spent enough time in India to know that many people say, oh, Hollywood, we got Bollywood, we've got this. You know, there's incredible national pride, I think it's fair to say. And so I would never want to diminish that, and that's in particular to India. But then the Nigerian movie industry, again, I mean, Lollywood, these in the model of, but at the same time, remarkably and wonderfully localized. And so I think that's partly a legacy, but it also... There's a wonderful, well, and sometimes not so wonderful, that vaulted expectation of what the U.S. represents, if that's fair to say. It's still, but I do hear what you're saying. When you bring that intersection of technology and art, and as transmedia becomes more of a reality, I think it's just going to continue to stitch that virtual community, and I think that can be very, very powerful, absolutely. Yes, in the back. Right.
Or mobile. Mm-hmm. And in mobile, you were mentioning a lot of references to texting. How are you seeing the introduction of smartphones either happening in emerging markets? So, like iPhone, think of how that's changing. You're able for the first time to get video, which is very difficult to get because of this disconnected internet experience there. Like, how do you see the smartphones sort of changing the evolution and what platforms people are using across the board?
Yeah, no. One of the debates is the race for the phone versus the laptop, which is going to win. And I don't really think it's an either or, but you certainly see the introduction more and more of smartphone technology. Depends on the country, certainly. Depends also. Let's remind ourselves that even though smartphones are becoming more ubiquitous in the United States, something like the iPhone is still their market share is quite small. Though we in Seattle might not imagine that to be true because we're saturated with it in some ways, given the rarefied circles that many of us operate in, whether we'd like to imagine that we do or not. But your question is an excellent one because there are some who would espouse, they would say, look, this arrival of smartphones is wonderful because they are more mobile, they are easier to introduce to some of these tropically, where you require tropically tolerant technology. I use the example of the somewhat disappointing one laptop per child project, and I don't mean to indicate that that's indicative of how laptops are integrating or being used, but I will say that there are those who are real advocates for the idea that cell phone technology, especially smartphone technology, is the answer. But, you know, I would go back to what one of our advisory board members at the MCDM said at one of our more recent meetings. He said, you know what, he held up his smartphone. He works for T-Mobile, and he said, when we say mobile these days, we're not just talking about a phone. We're now starting to talk about anything that you can carry with you, whether it's a tablet, a more compact netbook, a phone. And what's really going to be interesting is the integration between all these different technologies. How are we going to be able to move between the different platforms that we use? And that was very eye-opening to me because I realized that I was thinking about them in a much more compartmentalized way, a phone versus a laptop, when what Peter was saying is, let's think of it as devices. And I think that the successful device, in whatever shape it takes, in an emerging market is going to be one, this goes back to what Hirschman said, that is geared towards ordinary people. That then raises the question, to what extent is a smartphone geared towards ordinary people? I'd say right now we're still waiting for that market to come down where there's access, because they still tend to be a little bit out of reach. But when you talk about that sweet spot where you have excellent technology, great service, it works, but it also is appealing to ordinary people, we're not far, that's going to happen. We're going to find smartphones that work in that way. But it's interesting to think of it as, let's move beyond the idea of, is it a phone? It's a device. And what can the device do, and what is a particular emerging market going to need it to do? And what Hirschman was saying is the best technologies, and he was referring to the African continent, have been one that don't appeal just to the upper class, that can afford, that have real high levels of discretionary income. They're accessible to the masses, ordinary people. It's a good question. Yeah. And that's one example. I mean, that's... Well, but it also depends... I mean, I don't mean to put one laptop per child in a universally bad light. I really think it depends on the country context. There are examples, and one of them is actually in Rob's book, where the one laptop per child was a very successful rollout. Oh, good. Okay, thank you for that clarification. What I was going to say is, you were mentioning the one laptop per child, and then the idea of the cell phones and food. And I realize that introducing that particular anecdote, it requires a more intensive discussion, because I don't mean to suggest that that's universally happening. But that's just one example of the kind of conversations that are beginning to swirl around cell phone, or to the what extent are these products changing the way people prioritize their spending. And one of the big conversations that's coming out of M-Pesa now, and there's a lot of research being done at the Gates Foundation, is they're trying to move beyond this conversation of M-Pesa as a vehicle for moving money, and what they're now interested in is it actually helping people save money, as opposed to just a convenient way to get money from point A to point B. And I'm going to be interested to see that research. There are people who feel very strongly that it actually is encouraging a culture of saving. We'll see. I think it's too soon to tell on that front. But that's the next frontier in terms of scholarship around that kind of money movement.
Next year's lecture.
Can I hold? Can you hold? Because you're I love your comments, but let's do Robin and then back. Yeah, please.
Question for you. Ben.
Yeah.
A lot of these emerging economies are nevertheless very traditional societies.
Mm.
Sorts of things by giving people opportunities to explore ideas they haven't considered.
Right, that's a great question. I'm working with
an NGO here in Seattle called, well, they were called the Rural Development Institute until very recently, and now they're called Landesa. And one of the projects that we're looking at is, the Rural Development Institute / Landesa is very interested in the promotion of knowledge around land rights as a way of pulling people out of poverty. And one of the projects that we're working on is connecting, working in Uganda specifically, connecting lawyers in the capital with rural women via cell phone technology and actually working with some landline technology as well in terms of a hotline so that you can make women more aware of their rights around land technology. And I use this as just one example because when the idea was first rolled out, the question was, to what extent, given the fact that women are traditionally in this particular region of northern Uganda where they were working, somewhat marginalized, quite marginalized when it came to passing on land from household to household. And there's been such a tremendous amount of violence in northern Uganda that you've seen households ripped apart, but more than ever, there's a necessity for women to know that they actually do have rights under current legislative due process to land. And in this example, the idea that you could find a way to provide access to information that would then allow women to go back into an extended family or a tribal environment and actually be able to advocate on their own behalf. Again, it's new enough of a project that we're still waiting to see to what extent is their newfound information welcomed by the larger family, or does it end up backfiring, where it's seen as they're going beyond their role. But I do see that it's a disruptive technology right now, and the question is the end result something where their access to land is preserved and that then allows them to offer a better life for their children, or does it turn into a situation in some cases where there's marginalization? It's a little too soon to tell, but that's one example where we're trying to leverage technology to see to what extent people can be aware and mindful of legal claim that they have to land. In terms of the way that technology makes, I'm trying to think of another example, whether it's, I'm thinking of also some of my students who are really interested in gaming, and to what extent can gaming now play a role in the way that we absorb information or educational initiatives, and isn't there, I'm trying to think of there, I don't know the actual name, but the project of, oh, thank you. Oh, yes, that's true. Scott is reminding me that next week on April 14th, we're going to be hosting a salon with Jessica Alami, who is an author of another book that I brought tonight, Technology at the Margins. And Scott was just suggesting that there could be some good examples of Rob's question there, and so I've got the book and we have the example here. But back to the idea of gaming, I'm thinking there's a South African platform that I'm not remembering the name of, but this gets back to the question about education, but it was twinning the idea of gaming and education, especially around math skills, I believe, where it was actually a very successful platform in terms of increased competency, but at the same time using a non-traditional platform to engage around gaming. But I'll have to think more about that, because that's an excellent question. It would be neat to kind of consolidate some examples where the social norms have really been tipped.
I think the digital storytelling is helping that, because I went to their workshop, The Bridges, and they have worked with children, like young adolescents in Guatemala, I think it was, around the pollution issue in their area.
Mm.
So putting the cameras in the hands of the girls and the boys made them able to, like, educate the whole village to then take on the producers of the pollution. So it was sort of, and it didn't matter whether you were male or female. Once you had the tool, you could educate the different generations. And they showed the slideshow of that, and that's on their website. So I think that group that Phil Borges Foundation at Bridges is helping. Yeah, I think that's probably going to help, and it's a very simple tool. You just have to have a digital camera.
And Phil's latest initiative, they're actually a client in my class this spring, is called Stirring the Fire, and that's looking at the intersection of art and digital photography and women's and girls' rights. So that's going to be interesting to see that new initiative get off the ground. One last question in the back.
Is there a concern around
yes. I mean, I think issues of privacy and security are should be everybody's concern, no matter whether you're in an emerging market or not. And in fact, Morozov's book will give you plenty of examples of hair-raising tales, and in fact, the utilization of many of, especially the social technologies, we can get lulled into thinking that we're operating in an enclosed space, but in reality, it's very easy to leave that virtual trail. I mean, for instance, the M-Pesa example that you give about the transfer of things via cell technology, yeah, there's no question. I mean, this is not just in terms of the collection of data and where that data lives and the advent of cloud technology and the fact that as we move forward and more things are being stored in servers outside of the countries that the data is even generated in. And so you're going to be looking at these larger questions around who controls the data, who owns the data, how is the data accessed. Even from a more non-technological perspective, in terms of privacy and security, there are stories of people being able to, because it's so easy to transfer money through something like M-Pesa, there have been articles written about the ease in which you can ask someone, demand that someone transfer you money right in front of you, and that that you see that kind of compromise, that it can become compromised.
It's always nice to go back and repeat. The third lecture in the series was given by Craig Baker.
Oh, right.
Who posted what on Facebook?
Right.
He dealt with some issues of security and privacy. And all the lectures and all the audio for the lectures is available on the Blitz the Media blog, which you can find off our NCTM homepage. And Anita's will be up there in due course as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That the legalese and the privacy issues are very real, whether it's an emerging market or not, especially as you see multinational interests and the fact that very often, like with M-Pesa, there were international actors involved in the establishment of something like M-Pesa, that question of who owns the data. Thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you for that.